Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is the Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of September 10th, 2010. Sure, you've heard the saying, money can't buy you happiness. Well, if you've always thought to yourself, oh, really? I'd be happy to prove that wrong. You'll want to hear our story on money and happiness. It just might surprise you. Of course, if too much spending is your problem, there's a new wallet out there that could save you from yourself.
It's called the Mother Bear, and it has a hinge that can resist when you open it.
I want one of those. We'll hear about three digital wallets designed for a student at MIT to help track your finances. And the Great Recession has affected millions of people from all walks of life, but some places have been there, done that.
There weren't good jobs here in town, so when there's a downturn, people may say, what recession? We were already there.
A trip to Tennessee, but first, perhaps you don't care too much for money, because money can't buy you love. But apparently, it can buy you some measure of happiness. In the middle of this Great Recession, some Princeton economists got together and tried to come up with a number, an annual income, at which people would consider themselves happy. They found out that the more money you earn, up to $75,000, the happier you are. Beyond that, apparently, it's all gravy. We asked Marketplace's Elisa Roth to poke around and see how the study stacks up with reality.
I'm on Fifth Avenue. It's one of those stretches of New York that can make you feel poor, even if you're not. Saks Fifth Avenue is right behind me. Tiffany's a few blocks north. Prada's here, Armani. You get the idea. It's hard to argue that life would be better if you could afford an expensive pocketbook or a designer evening dress. But this new study, which appears in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, says earning more money does make you feel better about your life, to some degree. Daniel Kahneman is one of the authors.
I would describe that not so much as money buying happiness, but as lack of money buying misery. Below $75,000, people get increasingly unhappy.
To come to that conclusion, Kahneman, who's an emeritus psychology professor at Princeton, and his colleague Angus Deaton, who's an economist there, looked at hundreds of thousands of responses to surveys on well-being. What they found is people's happiness increases with their income, but they found that increase levels off after the $75,000 mark. People who earn more than that say they feel better about their lives generally, but how happy they are on any given day doesn't really change that much. One of the people I talked to is a man named Dennis Cruz. He says his experience has been similar.
What I feel money does for you is allow you to pay your bills so that you don't have to worry that you're not going to have a roof over your head. You're not going to have food in your kitchen.
He's a computer programmer. He says before the financial crisis, he was earning six figures. He just started a new job this week, which pays considerably less. He's grateful to have work. He was unemployed for a long stretch. But he's also afraid he's not making enough to pay his bills. Now, the study suggests Cruz would be happier if he earned more, but only if it were enough for him to stop worrying about money. If he started earning a lot more, he might not be a lot happier, though he'd probably feel better about his life, which is no small thing, but it's also not the same as how you feel right now. I asked Kahneman, one of the authors, what we should conclude from this.
You clearly need minimal income, but in addition, you need many other things, and mostly I think you need to spend time with people you like or love.
That's pretty much what another person I met, Michael Felis, told me. I met him on Fifth Avenue, coming out of Saks with his wife. He said he'd retired recently, so he's earning about a third of what he used to.
But my wife and I are very happy. We love each other. We have children. We love our children. And I think that's the whole thing. A happiness in life depends on your inner happiness and your happiness with your family.
When we finished talking, he and his wife continued walking down Fifth Avenue, holding hands. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace Money.
Elizabeth Dunn takes a different perspective on money and happiness. She says it's not about the size of your bank account, but rather how you spend what's in it and who you spend it on. She's an assistant professor of psychology at the University of British Columbia, and her research suggests that people are often happier when they spend their money on experiences rather than things. Professor Dunn, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Let's go with the title of your paper first, and it says, if money doesn't make you happy, then you probably aren't spending it right. So tell us what we're doing wrong.
Well, I think one problem is that people may be attracted to making major material purchases, buying fancy cars and big houses that I don't think we can actually expect to provide all that much in the way of lasting happiness.
So how do you know then what is too big to provide happiness and what isn't? I mean, how do you kind of define what those purchases are?
There isn't a sort of strict dividing line. The key thing is thinking about perhaps opportunity cost. Let's say that I purchase a really expensive new sound system. Depending on my income, that might perhaps reduce my ability to purchase, you know, some cool new song that comes out on iTunes that I'd like to buy. Maybe I might think twice if I've just emptied my bank account buying a big sound system. And what I would suggest is that we might actually be better off treating ourselves to those, you know, great new songs that come out rather than investing all our money in some extremely expensive sound system.
That's so interesting because, you know, I think that goes against some of the personal finance conventional wisdom that is out there. You know, this notion that if you want to save money, you know, cut out the $3 run to Starbucks every day or, you know, bring your lunch to work. But what you're really saying here is that the little things do make a difference for us.
Exactly. It seems that taking the time to enjoy the small pleasures of daily life is really important for our happiness. And in fact, one reason why having a lot of money doesn't seem to provide as much happiness as we might expect is that having tons of money can actually get in the way of our capacity to appreciate those little joys of daily life.
How so?
Well, I remember when I was a graduate student, I had no money. And so once in a while, I would treat myself to a $10 plate of pad thai, which was like a big indulgence at the time. And I would enjoy it so much. And now as a professor, obviously, I know professors aren't considered wealthy, but you're past that $75,000 point. So at this point, I'll just choke down a plate of pad thai without necessarily appreciating it because I know I can get it whenever I want.
Well, then I guess I have to ask, if the theory is that if money doesn't buy you happiness, then you're buying the wrong things, then how do we know what will make us happy?
Obviously, it's going to be a bit different for different people, but I think there are some useful guidelines. So one thing is try and consider, you know, how is this purchase going to affect the way you use your time? How is it going to affect your daily life? So something like a sweater is probably not going to influence your daily life, which suggests it's probably not going to have much of an impact on your happiness. Something like a lakeside cottage might actually have some downsides for your daily life. And I think that's really important to consider when we contemplate our purchases.
So what's the last thing you bought that made you happy?
I spent money this past weekend going on a surfing trip with some of my friends, and that made me very happy. We were camping, which was not exactly luxurious or expensive, but the one thing that we did was each day we went out for a really nice lunch after surfing.
A lot of the examples that you're giving are very experiential. Mm-hmm. They're not things. They're experiences.
Exactly. And I think one of the most interesting findings to emerge from psychological research has been that spending money on experiences can really be a lot better than spending money on material things.
So this research really seems to subvert a saying that we always hear, which is that money can't buy you happiness. So do you have a more appropriate saying for us?
Well, I would say that money doesn't usually buy happiness, but maybe it can buy us more if we spend it right.
Okay, we'll start using that one. Elizabeth Dunn is an assistant professor at the University of British Columbia and a co-author of a study called If Money Doesn't Make You Happy, Then You Probably Aren't Spending It Right. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Time to turn the mic around and hear a little bit of what you've had to say about our program. And here to help me check out our mailbag this week is our senior producer, Deborah Clark. Hey, Deb.
Hello.
So what do we have this week?
Well, some love, but also some not so much.
I'd like to start with the love, please.
Well, in the hopes we run out of time and don't get to the other.
Exactly. You know me well.
Fair enough. So a number of listeners wrote in about the interview you did on the Great American Apparel Diet.
Yeah, this was Sally Bjornson talking about going an entire year without buying any new clothes.
Yep. And not surprisingly, a bunch of women wrote in, many of whom found the idea thought-provoking, like Susan Blood from Charlotte, Vermont.
About 5 years ago, I made a bet with my husband that if I lost the bet, I would stop buying clothes for a year. And I lost the bet. What happened was that I just found I wasn't spending the emotional energy looking at clothes, thinking of what to wear, and it was just fine.
Good for her. Let me guess, did any men write in?
Well, yes, as a matter of fact. In particular, Mark Gluckman from Phoenix, Arizona, who said that it was the stupidest segment.
Oh, nice. I thought we were holding that bad stuff.
I know, but I thought this was really funny. He said essentially that men could go 5 years without buying clothes and think nothing of it. And it reminded me of when I first mentioned this idea at our editorial meeting that happened to have only men present at it. Mm-hmm. And I pitched it as a year without buying clothes. There was dead silence, no reaction at all, and then one male colleague said, oh, you mean like a normal year?
Yeah, well, having borne witness to the sartorial choices around that table, I can't say I'm terribly surprised. Moving on, anything else?
Some folks wrote in about a story we did about investing. Reporter Stacey Vanek-Smith did a story about how all this volatility in the market was making some younger investors change their portfolio allocation so they had less in stocks now than mm-hmm. financial advisors generally recommend. So 39-year-old Mike Eastman of Minneapolis said he's one of them.
Right now, my risk tolerance just isn't at the point where I can be in the stock market. There's too much uncertainty, and I would rather give up the potential gains over the next 3 to 5 years than face potentially larger losses.
And, you know, that's certainly understandable, but hopefully he is setting aside money somewhere else so he can eventually retire.
Right.
All right, what else?
Finally, Tess, a couple of weeks ago, you remember your conversation with David Lazarus. You talked to a young guy who was trying to figure out how to pay for his burgeoning DJ business.
Ah, yes, I remember it well.
Do you have a DJ name?
Yes, DJ Sven.
DJ Sven.
Sven?
Tess, do you have a DJ name? Snoop Tessie Tess?
Yeah, maybe not. So later I suggested DJ Jazzy Tess. Anybody? Yeah, I like that
one. Yeah, well, Robbie Clark of Atlanta, Georgia did not like that one.
I think it should be obvious to anyone that her DJ name should be DJ Tesseract. It's easy to rhyme, and it also suggests a certain level of erudition while setting a mental hook for action.
Well, so much for erudition. I don't get it.
Yeah, I have to be honest. I don't either. It's not that easy to rhyme with, and I had to look up what it meant.
And?
Well, I still don't really know. It's described as being the four-dimensional analog of the cube.
Oh, okay. Now I get it.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah.
Well, some of our friends on Facebook had a couple of other suggestions. You want to hear them?
Yeah.
Scott Pacodatus suggested DJ Tess Money, with the S's being dollar signs. Kind of like that one. And Darlene Mahegan had several. Not sure if they were for her or for me, but there's DJ Pretty Penny, DJ Miss Money, and DJ Need Alone.
Oh, I like that.
Among others, yeah. So, and I have one for you, Deb.
Uh-oh.
DJ Senior Producer, yo.
Yeah.
Many of our expectations about retirement were whipsawed by the financial crisis of 2008. So in a couple of weeks, we'll be talking with the CEO of TIAA CREF, which manages retirement plans for about 4 million people. We'd love to ask him some of your questions. To submit them, go to marketplace.org and click on the link that says Ask Roger. Coming up, the rest of your questions on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. And it's the time in the show where we take your money questions. And here with me to help out this week is Kathy Kristoff. She is the personal finance columnist for CBS Money Watch. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks very much.
So obviously this weekend we are marking the 9th anniversary of 9/11. But also this coming week we have another anniversary, which is the collapse of Lehman Brothers. Hard to believe that was 2 years ago.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Pretty much the start of the economic collapse. What are your thoughts about the events over the past couple of years since that?
Well, you know, I mean, I don't actually think that Lehman Brothers started the economic collapse. I think it actually started way, way, way before Lehman Brothers, although they made all of the problems that were causing the economic collapse transparent.
Right.
And so now all of a sudden when their mortgage operation just implodes, everybody starts looking around and going, oh my gosh, all of these mortgages that were written for all the wrong reasons and just because it was a huge bubble that triggered all the underlying things just started to go down like dominoes.
Right.
But they were there. Now I'm seeing a lot of good signs, even though everybody's worried about a double dip recession.
Right. Oh, you just hear that practically daily now.
Yeah, I'm probably like the only person in America who says, no, it's not going to be a double dip. It's going to be what kind of we predicted all along, is that it's going to take a really long time to dig out of this recession. And so even though the economy is growing, it's growing so slowly and falteringly that it's going to make people really nervous for a while. But I actually think that underlying that is a very good thing, because what you want to see in an economy like this, where you know what happened to cause all this problem, mm-hmm. what caused all this problem was debt. Now individuals are getting rid of that debt. And because they're getting rid of that debt, they're not spending a lot. And so the economy is not going to take off until everybody feels comfortable enough with their own finances to start going back to the mall and, spending with a little bit of reckless abandon. And that's just not going to happen immediately, but it will eventually.
But let me ask you this. This is something I've been asking over the last couple of years. We heard that the Great Recession, that the collapse of 2008 was going to be a sea change in behavior for all of us, consumers, government, corporations, that we were all going to get smarter about our money.
Right.
Just focusing on the consumers, we are not spending up to our, former capacity. But do you think that it's a permanent change? Do you think that we've really gotten smart about our money now?
I think we've gotten smarter. People have learned a lot in this stretch. People learned a lot about the markets when the markets crashed. And so now I think they're a little bit less likely to panic, although certainly there were a lot of people who panicked in 2008.
Yeah.
The question is whether you can apply that knowledge and make your life better. And that's what we're here for, right, Tess?
Exactly. Excellent segue, Kathy. Shall we see what our listeners, how they have applied their knowledge?
You bet.
All right. Well, Jay is with us, and he is in Mount Vernon, Ohio. Hi, Jay.
Hi.
How do you listen to the show there?
We listen to WOSU out of Columbus most often, but we usually listen to Marketplace via your podcast.
Aha, podcaster. Yes, more and more of you out there. Well, let me ask you, Kathy and I have been talking about the two-year anniversary of Lehman Brothers coming up, the two-year anniversary of the economic collapse. What have you learned?
What have I learned? That it's a good idea not to live beyond your means,
yeah.
I suppose,
Excellent.
And to have plenty of money in that rainy day fund. It helps you sleep a lot better at night.
So is that something that you have built up more over the last 2 years because it scared you a little bit?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I don't know that we did so consciously, but if I think about it, we do have more money set aside. That's true.
Good, good. Well, we always like to hear that, don't we, Kathy?
Absolutely. Very smart.
So what do you do there in Mount Vernon, Jay?
I am an economist. And
well, then of course you're saving money.
And here we are popping off about the economy. Maybe we should be quiet and just let you talk.
I'm not that kind of economist, as it turns out. Oh. I work at a local college where I teach courses about environmental economics and public policy. And certainly personal finance is not my specialty, which was why I was hoping to talk to all of you.
Okay. Well, what can we help you out with today?
Sure.
If you're not an expert in personal finance, but an expert in the economy?
I have a question about home mortgages and how they relate to college financial aid, looking well out into the future.
How well out? How young are your kids?
We have a 3-year-old and a 7-month-old.
Okay.
Wow.
Interest rates are, I understand, at historic lows.
Yep.
My wife and I, we recently had the chance to refinance our mortgage into a 15-year fixed-rate mortgage that would allow us to shorten the term of our loan by 4 years without changing our monthly payment. We thought this sounded great, in large part because we would be able to pay off our mortgage right before our 3-year-old starts at college.
Sounds great.
Now, being an economist, my colleagues and I at work spend what's probably an unusual amount of time talking about personal finance and these sorts of issues. So I get to work, and I was very enthusiastic, and I was telling my colleagues about what a smart thing I was about to do and all the money we were going to save, and they said, that's not nearly so smart as you think it is. They pointed out that colleges treat home equity as an asset that parents are expected to borrow against to pay for their kids' college education. And that in mind, I might be smarter to refinance into a 20 or even a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage. The interest rate would be a little bit higher, but my wife and I would have less home equity when our kids go away to college, and therefore we might qualify for more financial aid.
Well, first of all, Kathy, give us a rundown of where home equity falls in how student loans are allocated.
Okay, there's two answers, actually. If your kids go to a public university under current financial aid formula, your home equity does not count at all. And so that says 15-year mortgage, absolutely, right? But if they go to a private college, many private colleges have a different formula, and they do count home equity. But I'm still going to say, Jay, that you go with your instincts on this one, because here's the deal. You know, you really don't know what your kids are going to do. You don't know whether they're going to go to private colleges, public colleges. You don't know whether they're going to have scholarship possibilities. If you're earning a lot of money in the future, the thing that counts the most is your income.
Right.
If you earn more than, say, $100,000, your chance of getting a lot of financial aid is pretty minimal anyway.
Sure.
Generally speaking, when you're making a decision like this, make the decision that gives you the most options.
Right.
And paying off your mortgage actually is going to give you the most options. So absolutely listen to your instincts and tell your colleagues at work that, no, they're wrong.
Thanks so much. I can't wait to tell them that.
Okay.
I'm sure you'll very, very much enjoy telling your colleagues that they're wrong.
You'll pull up the podcast, won't you?
Yes. I'm going to email it out immediately.
Great.
All right. So does that answer your question there?
Yes, it does. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks, Jay. You know, Jay, I wonder... I'm seeing some notes here on our next caller, and I wonder if you might be willing to stick around for a while. I have a feeling we might actually be able to use you.
Sure. Happy to.
All right. Well, let's go to Grace, and she is in Mankato, Minnesota. Hi, Grace.
Hi.
How do you listen to the show there in Mankato?
On the radio at our house, we love listening to Marketplace Money and stuff.
Oh, I love that. Grace, how old are you?
I'm 14.
You're 14. Wait a minute. Aren't you supposed to be in school?
Well, I am in school.
Oh, you are? Oh, are you like out in the hall making a secret call or something?
No, I'm in the office.
Okay.
I'm in the office right now.
Okay. Yeah. What subject do you like there?
I'm into science, definitely.
That's great. What do you want to do when you grow up, Grace?
I want to be an astrophysicist.
Whoa. Holy cow. All right. I love that.
Just, it's someone that works with physics and space and black holes and quasars and all that. And
so does this interest in science mean you're also good at math?
Yeah, I am. Well, I think I am.
So are you good with your money?
Well, I don't know. Right now, I don't actually have any money because I'm just paying off things to my mom.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. You took out a loan from mom?
Sort of. Yeah. I went to Oregon this summer, and I paid for the plane ticket. So for a while, I was just saving up money, and then she lent me a bit of money, and I've just been paying that off, and now I want to get contacts, so I'm trying to save up money for that.
Well, tell us what we can help you out with then today. You owe your mom a little bit of money, but after that, are you hoping maybe to save some up?
Yeah, and also, I just want to know how, at a young age, I can save money in a bank account or something else so that when I am older, I have more money.
Uh-huh. And how much would you like to save, say, per month?
You know, I really don't know. I don't have a job yet. I just do work around the house.
Okay. Tell you what, our previous caller, Jay, has been on the line. And guess what? He's an economics professor. So he likes to think about stuff like this, right, Jay?
Yes, I do.
All right. Well, so if Grace started saving, I don't know, say 10, 20 bucks a month.
Sure.
How much would that be when she's, say, 50?
So economists like to think of something called the rule of 70. And the way that that works is that you take the number 70 and you divide it by the rate at which you expect your money to grow each year.
Huh.
And then the answer that gives you is the number of years it would take for your money to double. if you were planning on investing in the stock market over the long term, just as an example, it might not be unreasonable to expect a 7% rate of return each year. In that case, 70 divided by 7% is going to give you 10. So your money would double about every 10 years.
Wow.
So if Grace, then, is talking about putting away money today for when she's 50, that's roughly 40 years from now. So, so Grace's money would double about four times. If she were to put away $10 today, that would become, well, what, $20, $40, $80, $160 when she's 50 years old. And if she left it there 10 more years, it would be $320, and 10 more years would be $640, and so on.
Per $10.
Per $10,
that's
yeah.
The power of compounded growth.
Wow, Grace, what do you think of that math?
I guess if I were to put $100 away this year, I'd have quite a bit more money then, instead of just $10. So
you certainly would.
Yeah, it makes a big difference.
Yeah.
Depending on what your goals are. I mean, the first thing I'd say to you is always save for something, right? And so you say you're saving for contacts right now. And so that's going to be an immediate term goal. Put half of the money aside for that, and then put half of the money aside for a goal to be named later. For the immediate money, you save in bank accounts because that money, it's very secure. The other half of your money that it's for a goal to be named later, you can invest in stocks because your bank account right now is going to earn you maybe 1% interest. Your stock market investments, on average annually, stocks have returned about 9% per year. Yeah, so that's a lot better, but you have to be in it for the long haul because stocks never actually, in any given year, it's never going to earn 9%. There's a website called ShareBuilder, and it will allow you to invest really small amounts of money. So that's a good way to get in when you don't have, you know, hundreds of dollars to invest.
Yeah. So let me ask our economist, Jay, does that sound good to you?
Sounds reasonable to me.
All right. Hey, Jay, thanks for sticking with us.
Yeah, you're very welcome.
Bye-bye.
Thanks,
bye.
Jay.
All right, so Kathy, ShareBuilder perhaps for Grace's longer-term savings, and then just a basic bank account for the shorter term?
Yep.
Okay.
Grace, this is fantastic that you're so responsible. I am sure your parents are really proud of you. I would be delighted if my kids, you know, did what you're doing.
Thank you.
Hey, good luck, and let us know how that saving is going.
Thank you so much for the advice.
It is our pleasure. Thanks for calling the show.
Have a great day.
Bye.
All right, and finally we have James, and he is with us from Brooklyn, New York. Hi, James.
Hello.
How do you listen to the show there?
I stream it. I used to live in Duluth, Minnesota, and I got quite attached to Minnesota Public Radio while living there.
Yeah, well, I can tell that you are not from Brooklyn.
I'm not. I'm actually originally from Iowa and moved to Minnesota after grad school, so...
All right. So what do you do there in New York?
I'm a geographer, and I do research on obesity and physical activity and the built or the urban environment.
Wow.
Well, then what do you do for fun there if you're a geographer by day?
Well, for fun, this has actually something to do with my question, is I'm interested in wine and growing grapes.
Man after my own heart.
Yeah, really.
So that's a very hard thing to do in New York City. I intern at a winery on Long Island and just trying to learn more about the wonderful world of wine.
I love that. So what's your question then? I can help you maybe with wines, but I can't help you with the... we'll see if we can help you with the finances of wine.
Since I'm from Iowa, I've planted a small vineyard on my parents' property.
Oh, how fun.
I have an interest in having a larger vineyard, and it's challenging since I live in New York, but I make it back as often as I can, and I have family back there that help me.
How many vineyards are there in Iowa, do you know?
Currently, there's 80 to 82 licensed wineries.
Wow.
Take that, Napa. What kind of grapes are you growing?
Well, I grow four different varieties, Frontenac and Marquette. Those are the two reds.
Hmm. Okay.
And then the whites are Frontenac Gris and St. Pepin.
Huh. Okay. I am not familiar with any of those. So will you be sending us a sample of your first crushing?
Well, I certainly could.
I mean, how can we give you advice if we don't know what it tastes like?
Exactly. Well, so are you looking for some help in financing this venture?
Yeah, so I'm looking, you know, I would like to plant more grapes, and I would like to purchase a piece of land.
In addition to the land that you have with your parents?
Yeah, okay. Just because it's only, I only have like just under half an acre planted there.
Oh, okay.
So I've hunted around a little bit to see what types of loans or funding would be available. The only thing I've really come up with are commercial loans or agricultural loans. Most of them have either a 5 or 10 year balloon, and the interest rate 6.25% to 6.5%. And with interest rates so low right now on, you know, refinancing your residential property, it just drives me nuts that I can't find something more competitive with those rates.
Yeah, I'll tell you why you're not finding something more competitive. What you have is kind of a combination real estate loan and a business loan. And so the way your lender is looking to be repaid is from a return on your business. And so that's a risky proposition because people are generally most reluctant to give up the roof over their heads. But a business loan, if your grapes have a bad year, now how are you going to pay on that loan? That's why that loan rate is going to be considerably higher. And unfortunately, those are really your choices. You can check with the Small Business Administration and see if they can help you get, you know, startup capital. But you're generally going to be speaking about a business or a farm loan. And those are just more costly.
Right.
If your family is all involved in this business, can you get mom and dad to move to a bigger plot of land and finance it as a home mortgage?
Well, they actually live on a big plot of land, but you don't want to grow grapes just anywhere. You know, you want well-drained soils, and you want soils that are preferably on a steeper southern slope so they get more sunlight. And ultimately, it's a vineyard, so you want it to be aesthetically pleasing.
Yeah, you got a lot of factors working against you, it sounds like.
Yeah, this is going to be tough. Unfortunately, there's just no cheap way to finance that.
Okay.
All right. Well. So when you do get this started, if and when, do you have a name for your wine?
I do not.
May I give you a suggestion?
Sure.
Marketplace Money Honey. How's that?
Oh, okay. I guess then I'd have to start making mead wine, but...
Oh, that's true. That's right. All right, James, thanks for the call.
Sure, thank you.
All right. Well, unfortunately, that is all the time we've got for this week. I raise my glass to you, Kathy Kristoff.
Well, thank you. If only there was something in it.
I know. Maybe James can help us out with that later down the line. But do remember, if you've got a money question, we will do our best to answer it. Do give us a call. It's 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, or send us an email through the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. Kathy Kristoff, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks, Tess.
And remember to always check with your own financial professional before you make any big money decisions. Here in California, you don't have to go far to find evidence of how deep this recession has been, especially in housing. Sunbelt states saw the boom and bust up close, but elsewhere, the housing crisis reared its ugly head in different ways. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson spent 2 weeks traveling through Tennessee for our series on how the recession played out in the middle of the country. In Memphis, he found that for struggling homeowners, the difference is as simple as black and white.
On one of my first days here, I shared a barbecue dinner of dry rub pork ribs with a young white financial advisor named Jamie Cochran. I asked him how he and his clients see the state of the economy.
You know, I think the United States of America is ready to bounce back. There's economic indicators. Some of them are saying yay, some of them are saying nay on a bounce back. But for the most part, I would say a lot of them are looking pretty optimistic.
That's one view, but you don't have to travel far from the barbecue shop in Midtown to find a very different prognosis.
You know, a neighborhood like this was in a recession before the recession.
Steve Lockwood is a community organizer. He heads a group that's trying to improve economic conditions in the heavily black and extremely poor neighborhood of Fraser.
There weren't good jobs here. There is not transportation to what few good jobs there are here in town. So when there's a downturn, people may say, what recession? We were already there.
Fraser used to be what Lockwood calls an affluent working-class community, but over the last several decades, factories have closed, and the housing crisis added insult to injury. Many homeowners were convinced to get into new mortgages for some extra cash. They took adjustable-rate loans, and when the rate went up, they couldn't afford the payments. The city has sued a major lender, claiming it targeted African-American neighborhoods with high-cost loans. Now, on some blocks, every other house is abandoned.
We think that the ownership rate in the 8 years that I've been here has dropped from 65% to 35%.
And what does that do to a neighborhood when the ownership rate goes down like that?
It tears up the fabric.
He says crime is rampant. Squatters fill many of the abandoned homes. Lockwood took me on a drive through the worst-hit areas of Fraser.
Looking to see if we had a cage around the air conditioner, which we do.
Why? So that nobody takes us?
Yeah. That's part of the economy here, is turning $1,400 air conditioners into $50 worth of scrap metal.
Cash here is king because credit scores are low. Lockwood tells me 540 is the average score of the people who come to him asking for assistance. And the payday lenders here charge as much as 264% interest. Add it all up, he says, and it's hard for those who live here to move up.
It, bleeds over into a lot of their life, and they frankly think they've made a lot of bad decisions. I live in a neighborhood that's done pretty well. I don't think I'm any smarter than these guys. I got lucky and they didn't, you know?
And this is the front of the house. It's pretty nice, and my neighborhood's real quiet. And
in one of the mixed-race, middle-class neighborhoods of East Memphis, Henry Carradine is showing me his home. He's not sure he and his three kids will be here long. He went through a divorce recently. Now he's fallen behind on payments for an adjustable-rate loan that had failure written all over it.
He made it look like it was so easy in order to get in the house and be able to afford it. 2 years, and 2 years, your credit be A1, and you could just come back and refinance it with a fixed rate, and it shouldn't be a problem. 2 years came around. No way.
Carradine admits he was unprepared to comprehend the fine print on his loan. Now he's trying to make reduced monthly payments to avoid foreclosure and bankruptcy. He says better financial literacy would have made all the difference. And that's a story the mayor of Memphis has heard 1,000 times before.
It's no great secret that in this town, poverty is basically another way of saying black or brown.
From his City Hall office overlooking the Mississippi River, Mayor A.C. Wharton can see the effects the home foreclosure crisis is having on the city's majority black population. But it's the future that scares him.
It becomes intergenerational. Dad is crushed. He'll never try that again. Son, seeing the hurt on daddy's face in a few years when he's out on his own, you think he's going to start putting away to try to buy a house? Mm-mm. So it's immeasurable in terms of what consequences we're going to see down the road.
In Memphis, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace Money.
And Jeremy asked everyone he met in Tennessee whether they are feeling a recovery. You can see their responses and give us an answer of your own at marketplace.org. Next story is about another population on the harsh receiving end of the recession. This time it's not a black and white issue. It's a multicolor and multicultural issue involving refugees. About 80,000 of them will come to the U.S. this year, but the minute they arrive, a clock starts ticking. Most refugees get about 8 months of federal aid before they are on their own, and the competition for even the most basic jobs is fierce. Sadie Babbitts has more from Portland, Oregon.
In Portland, almost everyone who's resettled by the U.S. government gets help from the Immigrant and Refugee Community Organization. Lucy Merlot works at IRCO, and it's her job to find work for those refugees. I asked Merlot just how difficult it's been to find jobs during the recession.
Goodness. Very challenging because there's about 1,000 applicants for one job. We're encountering that.
She wants me to meet Mervin Avila, who arrived from Cuba a few years ago. He's middle-aged, thin and wiry.
Avila says he got by okay the first year, working as an assembler for a window company and a line cook at a Mexican restaurant. But that temporary work ran out, and Merlot's been trying to find him a job for the past 2 years. I meet Avila out in Urco's parking lot. He drives an old Datsun pickup with a camper shell on the back. And over those last 2 years, this truck has been his home.
The economy has had me sleeping on the street. That truck doesn't have insurance.
Avila tells me he still gets $200 a month in food stamps, which he usually sells for money. Then he skimps on food he buys so he'll have enough left over for gas and emergency truck repairs. Avila used to be a radio host in Cuba, but he says he also did construction on the island's fancy hotels. Now, he's willing to do any job.
He says, I even applied to go to Alaska and they haven't called me yet.
Is that what you're waiting on now, is to go up to Alaska to work on a cannery?
Esperando en Alaska, para el trabajo de Alaska en estos momentos.
Sí, pero no me llamaron y yo trabajo donde quiera.
He says, I'm waiting, but I still haven't heard from them, and I work anywhere.
Merlot says Avila has plenty of skills despite his lack of English, but she says employers don't care.
Why hire somebody who has limited, language capabilities when we can hire somebody who's fluent in English, like an American?
Even when her clients speak fluent English, she can't find them work. Take Nawaris Almirza. He's from Iraq and came to Portland 7 months ago. Almirza is 25 years old, and he has a bachelor's degree in engineering and communications. He worked with U.S. Special Forces in Iraq, and he thought he'd have no problem getting hired in the U.S.
I applied for a lot of jobs, beginning with the basic jobs like working with the grocery stores or restaurants or hotels.
He couldn't find any entry-level jobs, let alone work as an engineer.
I'm a legal engineer here in the States. I can work, but nobody can hire me because... Do you have experience here in the States? Which company did you work for? I have no experience here in the States.
Almirza decided he couldn't wait any longer. He joined the U.S. Army, and in May, he reported for duty as a unit supply specialist. He'll be in charge of equipping troops with everything from towels to weapons. Almirza says he's looking forward to his new job, but less than half of the refugees coming to the U.S. this year will find work, according to Kay Ballore. She's the vice president of the International Rescue Committee. Ballore says the bad economy has caused refugees to experience stress levels similar to the trauma they faced in their home countries, even for Iraqi refugees who've just left a war zone.
And to come seeking safety and have the safety, but then realize that, you're faced with the possibility of not being able to keep that roof over your head, it's a huge strain on the refugees.
It's a strain that employment specialist Lucy Merlot knows all too well. She says refugees face evictions. Some have turned to illegal activities like dealing drugs and prostitution. Merlot says they're getting desperate and frustrated, even with her.
They're trusting that we are going to be their saviors. And the reality is that we are trying our best to assist them, but we have our hands tied.
Merlot and the relief agency she works for have their own set of challenges. Urco recently laid off a handful of staff members to keep the books in the black. For now, its budget is safe until the new fiscal year begins in October. After that, even Lucy Merlot may be looking for work. In Portland, Oregon, I'm Sadie Babbitts for Marketplace Money.
Here's one to light up the phones and perhaps our Facebook page. How should couples handle their money? Well, you could pool your income or keep things completely separate. Divvy up the mortgage, the grocery bill, the babysitter money. Here's what some of our colleagues at Marketplace do.
My husband and I have completely separate finances.
We have a single account.
We deal with our finances together.
We do have our own separate accounts.
My wife and I share a bank account.
But the accounts are empty.
When we go out to eat, it usually works without us even saying it.
When I'm playing, it's usually in an area where I don't need any money, like I'll go up into the mountains or I'll go surfing or something.
I will pay if he paid last time.
So whenever I'm going to be spending money, she's pretty much always there.
Sometimes he forgets, a lot of times he forgets.
The truth is, I'm the bill payer.
And so I will remind him when it's his turn.
I've taken control.
She likes skin products, and I'm a hobby furniture maker, so I buy lots of power tools.
So now maybe afterwards I can have like $100 a month of my own to spend what I want, which would be comic books.
And now it's your turn. We've set up a poll about couples and finances. It's at marketplace.org, or head over to our Facebook page and tell us your story. The weight of your wallet doesn't quite tell you how much you have in the bank, but wouldn't it be nice if it did? A group of MIT Media Lab students got together on a class assignment to create three special wallets, each with its own way of telling you what's happening with your money. John Kessner came up with the idea, and he joins us with some explanation. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So this was all started by a class assignment. Tell us what your assignment was.
The class is called Tangible Interfaces, and it's really just all about finding new ways to understand digital information. And no pun intended, I had this idea in my back pocket. So it was this was a great opportunity to explore that idea and build something. So
how did you come up with your idea, the virtual wallet?
Well, it really just comes at examining my own life and the friction points there.
So when you say a friction point, does that mean that money is a friction point for you?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I consider myself a cheapskate overall, but at the same time, since like everyone else, my money has been abstracted into a computer database somewhere, you know, I don't really have a good idea of what's going on, and I want a better idea of what's going on.
Well, let's get right to it then and describe for folks what we're talking about here. And I called it a virtual wallet, but you actually call it a proverbial wallet?
Right. They call it a proverbial wallet because, you know, we have a triptych of them, and each one is kind of meant to tell a little fable, maybe a lesson about saving money. So one of them is called the Bumblebee, and it has a vibrating motor in it. And it has different little buzzing patterns that are mapped to transactions going through your bank account. The idea here is to tie together your action of making a payment, giving someone a credit card, with the actual consequences. Because when you give someone a credit card, that's not when you actually lose the money, as far as your bank is concerned, right? That's how you do something like overdraft, for example. You know,
yeah.
You are not in sync with your digital money. And so it has different patterns depending on whether it's money coming into your account or money leaving.
Okay, so you call it a bumblebee because it basically kind of buzzes
your
posterior
yeah.
at the appropriate time?
Exactly.
What is then the purpose of that? Is that essentially to make you more aware of how often there is money going in and out of your accounts during the day?
Yeah, and it's not just how often, but when. And the idea is that this kind of gets down at a visceral level in the same way that I'm not necessarily keeping score as I am handing out dollar bills or getting them back.
Right.
But just by having them go through my fingers, I kind of have this unspoken sense of it.
All right, then, wallet number two?
Wallet number two is, I think, the most perfect one because it is most wallet-like. It's called the Mother Bear, and it has a hinge that can resist when you open it.
I want one of those.
That's what everyone says. So the idea is you might map this to some monthly budget goal that you have, and towards the end of the month, you'll find it getting a little harder to open. And it's just supposed to inform you a little bit that, do I really need this thing that I want to buy? And so this kind of jumps over all the hoops you got to go through to go check your bank statement. And you don't have to think about the idea in the first place. It pushes the information to you.
All right. And wallet number three?
Wallet number three is probably the artsiest. It's called the Peacock, and it simply gets thinner or fatter with your overall money situation.
Oh, so this is where you want your wallet to be really fat.
Yeah. You know, this is another one of those kind of visual jokes, I guess, that if you have a fat wallet, you know, people know where you know, how you're doing. But of course, that's not so true anymore now that we all just have credit cards and debit cards.
Right. We don't have those wads of bills in there.
Exactly.
Given that you chose money and the wallet for your class project, what does that tell us about your finances? Which one would most befit you?
Definitely the hinge.
The mother bear.
Yeah. I do like setting goals for myself and trying to meet them, but I need a much tighter feedback loop. And that's the nice thing about this. You know, I don't have to go running back to a computer or logging anything in a checkbook. And does anyone balance checkbooks anymore?
Good question.
But I mean, that it's a good thing to do. I mean, it kind of creates this sense of, you know, it's mindfulness. It's good to have this exercise of knowing how much money you have all the time. But it's one of those things that once we let computers take care of it for us, we lose the handle on all of it, you know.
John Kessner is a grad student at the MIT Media Lab, and we've been talking about his new creations. What did we call them? They're not virtual wallets. They're proverbial wallets. Yes. Well, thanks so much. It's been awfully fun talking to you.
Thank you. I enjoyed talking with you as well.
Want one? Well, you'll have to wait because these are just prototypes, but you can find images for each wallet at marketplace.org. And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, Facebook Places, Foursquare. Companies have all kinds of tools to track you these days, and for some reason, you let them.
I understand the consequences very clearly now, and I'm very particular about how I behave using that tool.
But she learned that lesson the hard way. Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Devin Robbins and Stephen Hoffman. Our technical director is Josh Robeson. The theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, offering long-term investment strategies built on experience, discipline, and research. On the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. This is Putnam Today.
American Public Media.